Okay, so I am going through it, but also who isn't? Like, I'm slowly getting back on my bullshit, but it has been tough. Like, the last few years in the Panasonic, life in general beyond that. But, we move, and I am definitely very, very grateful for therapy, which is today's episode. But also, I'd love to hear how you're going. Yeah, it's been a while. How are you going? Shoot me a message. I am genuinely curious. We talk about a lot today, not just therapy, but also therapists themselves, therapy as a service, and how we can get the most out of it. We center Black women in this conversation, but I really think that there is so much to take away from this, no matter who you are, whether you're hesitant to see a therapist, haven't seen one before, if you're in therapy now and have been for some time, or if you hope to be, or if you should be. Anyway, I share a little bit about my experience when I first started going to therapy at around 18. I'm 25 now, and it has been a journey to get to my current therapist, who is a Black African woman. And yeah, you'll hear about the wildness that has occurred, but I know that so many struggle with finding the right therapist for them, especially folks who sit at multiple intersecting identities. Like, if you're Black and queer, or if you're trans, if you're disabled, it can be really hard to find the right therapist for you who sees you and who can understand you. And we talk about that a lot in this conversation. I'm also grateful for the privilege of being able to access therapy. It shouldn't be a privilege. I think everybody should be able to have mental health support, but unfortunately, in this capitalist society, it is. And I also want to send like big love to the people who are working day in and day out to create more affordable, more accessible mental health access globally, and the therapists who are doing it, who are just completely transforming how therapy works and serving so many minoritized peoples. So Tigis, today's guest at the Tenor Therapist on Instagram, I will leave her Instagram in the bio. She is not your average therapist, okay? I respect and cherish Tigger so much. She is so fun and she's honest and she brings a structural analysis while also weaving in her own personal stories and experiences and such a fierce critique of health in general and mental health resources from a Black point of view, which we definitely don't hear enough of in mainstream mental health conversations. This is not therapy though, okay? This is not a substitute for therapy. Go to therapy. Before she introduces herself, let's cue the intro. You're listening to The Subtlety of It. My name is Nina. This podcast is about seemingly small aspects of our identity, which actually affect us in not so subtle ways. They really inform who we are and how we navigate the world.
My name is Tigis Kavidi. I am a therapist. I work in the counseling space. I do it privately in a private practice, but I'm not representing parapsychology here. I am representing myself. I also work in nonprofit settings as well. And you know what it is? It's like you have to, sorry, but it's like you have to do this flex without a flex. So it's like, I want to talk about myself and I want to do this, but at the same time you're like, but I have to be humble because that's really rude. So I was like, can you flex for me?
No,
just tell everyone.
Definitely, like in my intro, which I'll record later, I'll definitely be gassing you up in the intro. Don't even worry about it. Like, you can keep it cute and humble in this little section here.
Just recording.
How did you become a therapist?
The first part is the answer I used to tell myself is how I became a therapist. And the answer later on in life I learned of why I probably, the roots of why I became a therapist, right? I became a therapist because I thought I was just someone who would always listen and provide really good advice. So I'm like, you know what I should do? I should get paid for that, right? So that's the short answer. after doing therapy and supervision and like a degree and then reading a lot of shit, I realized that I most likely became a therapist because I'm an immigrant first daughter. I people please. I do all this stuff where I like consider everyone else and don't consider myself because of maybe the way I was raised, the culture. Maybe it's because of how I identify and how I'm able to like survive growing up and then experiencing various trauma throughout my life. That I think is probably what kind of led me here. These adaptive strategies that became like a pattern of behavior. So I was like, oh yeah, I'm really good at this. I'm really good at shutting up and listening to people talk about their hardest and deepest and, you know, vulnerable parts of themselves. Like, who signs up for that?
That's a hard job. It's a hard job.
I just listen to everyone's problems and never talk about mine and be there for you and hold you through that and like help you through that. I think it definitely was shaped by my childhood experiences. It was definitely shaped by how I was as in friendship circles and all that kind of stuff. And now I'm doing therapy and I'm you know, not only as a client, but also someone who provides therapeutic services to someone else. I'm learning to unlearn some of those things. And that was part of my journey to be a therapist. And there's a lot of like in jokes within, you know, psychology, within social workers and all that kind of helping professions that we all kind of did it to all like deal with our own shit. I'm such a good person for doing this, when really it's like I've actually got a lot of trauma myself and I'm trying to unpack it, right? So
that's so interesting.
Yeah, I think it's, you know, yeah, I think the real answer is the second answer, but the first answer is like the fun answer and the one I wished it was.
No, I love the honesty, and it's cool hearing those like two answers, how you became honest with yourself. And I love how you've already dragged yourself like lovingly.
With kindness and affection. There's nothing wrong with that little, like, a little very empathetic and soft drag, you know. Talk to me nice. Talk to me nicely, but still be honest and drag me, but nicely, yeah? Don't get too don't get too comfortable and call me out on some names and stuff because I'm very sensitive.
Yes.
But also keep it real. And the real answer was that. The real answer was I had some shit that I needed to deal with.
Yeah.
And I thought the best way to deal with it is to go into debt and go to university and make this my profession. Okay.
Yeah.
That's how I dealt with my shit, right? So maybe you can deal with your shit, not the same way that I did, and just get a therapist.
Honestly. But I also wonder as well, you're talking about being like an immigrant first daughter. Shout out to the immigrant eldest daughters. That's not me. I'm the youngest, but shout out to my sister Alma because
No, seriously, no, immigrant first daughters, or just like I come from a refugee background. So as a refugee, and then on top of that, being like a daughter in kind of like particular ethnic groups or racial backgrounds, and then being like the first daughter as well. Not that there's only two of us, really. Like, but
still.
But even being a girl in that dynamic, I think is, gosh, like, talk about wanting to like over succeed just to like, you know, make up for all that. Like, I have to be good at school. I have to be, you know, model minority. I have to be model daughter. I have to be this and that, you know, all that kind of plays into it. And so shout out to you all. I'm here for you. I see you.
It really is a lot. But yeah, thanks for sharing about your background. I'm also just like really curious because also you're a Black African woman in this space as a therapist. And it's been interesting over the past like few years how much who your therapist is impacts your therapy. My past therapists have actually had one white woman and one white man, but I did realize that I was spending a lot of time bringing that cultural nuance, that racial nuance to the conversation. And I actually found that to be quite draining. They were really eager to learn and really eager to like
learn from you,
but it was becoming a lot. When I was looking for a new like Black, specifically a Black woman therapist, I would almost like Psychology Now or Counseling Now.
Psychology Today.
It was like anybody like remotely brown or with a tan, I was like, open new tab, I'm gonna see who this person is, because I was like desperate to find somebody.
And let's begin with what your experiences were with therapy in general, with two people a white man and a white woman, right? So therapy or mental health is not separate to the rest of the world. If white supremacy can exist in the rest of the world, it can exist and does exist and thrives in therapeutic spaces, right? So we really need to be really aware of that. And just because someone is your therapist doesn't mean that they're unaffected by any kind of socioeconomic, political privileges, or that their identity is not going to influence that conversation. Now, whether or not that is your responsibility, it, you know, that's your choice as an individual. But what I say is that the therapist is providing a service. You are not. So you going to a therapist and having to educate them about whatever identity you have or whatever experience that you have is an issue. And if that is like, you know, just one thing that maybe they just didn't get a certain nuance or a certain, you know, very specific detail that, you know, like maybe not everyone would understand, right? But if this is something like race, culture, gender, sexuality, religion, if you're sitting there going, by the way, my therapist, let me explain to you what Islam is and how Islamophobia works. Who is now providing the service?
Woo, that's a word. That's a word.
So I think it's really, really important that we understand that sometimes certain people cannot provide for us. Now, it's not your responsibility in a paid service or when someone is providing you something for you to have to do that. What you can do instead is you can ask them to be accountable. You can say that to the therapist and say that, you know, I feel like I'm having to explain this to you. Some people don't feel comfortable doing that. And therapy that exists here in predominance is Eurocentric. It is white focused. We're talking about a concept of you having to go into a room by yourself to talk about certain issues with one person. How many cultures do that? Not a lot of cultures at all. Whether it be here in Australia, so Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander communities speak about this endless conversations around how their healing is as a community. Yes, they can do it individually one-on-one, but often it's the mob that does it together, and they enter spaces, they enter healing circles together, and they have practices together, whether that's oral practices, whether that's through art. African cultures, by and large, do things in communal settings, whether it's their grief, whether it's their joy, whether it's their celebrations. All those things happen in communal settings. So our healing happens in communal settings, but also a lot of our trauma happens in communal settings. Yeah. It's the idea that I'm going to send you off by yourself to talk about this, and it's your issue, that for a lot of people is quite difficult. And on top of that, you go into these spaces with people who don't do that work. If you're not doing work around your privilege, if you're not doing work around white supremacy, if you're not doing work around understanding identities, then how are you going to understand their behavior? How are you going to understand their thought process? How are you going to understand their feelings? And how are you going to understand their healing? And you're not there at the start, so you're not going to be there at the end. And I think that's the reason why so many people go to therapists, not just of color, but of similar religions, of similar abilities, of similar identities. It's really, really hard for people, A, to go to therapy in the first place because of how difficult we make getting help to be, how much stigma we make getting help to be. And a lot of decolonized work includes decolonizing mental health and decolonizing therapy and saying, hey, you know that yoga that you think is so great? How about we actually don't put a white woman in front of it? And go back to the original roots and go, hey, this occurred from India. This is an Indian culture. Let's utilize their resources from them. And utilizing, like, I think people are using African drumming now. African drumming helps. It helps with breathing. It helps with movement of your body. But the people that are doing this are like white people. Why do we create structures and why do we create theories from Europe? Not that they're not relevant, they're relevant. I utilize their work, but we have systemically and systematically, as two separate things, silenced and not included voices of other communities. Anyone who's not white, male, of a particular class and a particular ability, often Christian, their voices don't get heard until what, 20 years ago? Like, other communities haven't been existing for centuries. I think when we're thinking about therapy, we need to understand that this too can be a place of oppression if it wants to be.
Yeah, no, that's amazing, Tigis. I think going back to your like community care and community people doing trauma and healing and celebration together as a community, but then that being in stark contrast to a lot of the colonial constructs in mental health, in therapy, in well-being, how does that impact that person and why is that harmful?
I think it impacts people because the colonial structure, if what our history has shown us, is that if you don't fit the mold, there's something wrong with you. So an example would be a lot of Black girls, so a lot of African girls that I see, who for a very long time didn't think that they were pretty. And this is just a very simple example of growing up in a school and not seeing other people like you, or being given compliments when your hair is straightened, or when it's, you know, less messy, more upkept, and little microaggressions over time that are both sexist and racist at the same time. And then over time, you go, oh, no, no, it's not a them issue, it's a me issue. And I think this is how it affects us, because it individualizes us. Now, this is not a sweeping statement to say that a lot of people's reasons for therapy aren't individual. They are. But I think what makes people go towards therapists who look like them or sound like them is the idea that I want to be seen as I am without having to justify my existence here. And that should be your human right. But unfortunately, in this society, it's seen as a privilege. So that's what you're taking into the therapeutic space. You just want to be going like, hey, I just want to talk to you about XYZ. It's not like, sorry, how do I pronounce your name? Sorry, how many people in your family? What's going on?
So did you say that's haram? What does that mean? Explain that for me for a second.
Like, I don't think people want to go through that. Mm. And that's just one thing. I'm also a therapist, which means I have the therapeutic modalities. I utilize various techniques. I'm still good at my shit. Even if the person's not Black, I've seen people from all walks of life for varying issues, right? You want the most minoritized and the least seen people in the community to feel just as seen and just as heard and just as wanted.
I'm wondering, like, from a Black African standpoint, do you think that Black African people, or Black people more generally, should have a Black therapist if they can access one?
I don't think you need to see a Black therapist if you are Black. And there's a lot of reasons to this. Firstly, every therapist you should be able to see, and they should all have the capacities. Yeah. Some have better skills around certain themes and topics because that's their speciality. But you should be able to see any therapist. And if need be and you can't get a therapist, see a therapist, regardless of what they are.
Yeah.
If you desperately need help, see a therapist, right? Secondly, Black people, as well as any other minority group, should have the right to be able to see people out of their community. So when you have proximity, it can be both a great thing, but it can also be a real challenge. So the great thing is, hey, you know, I'm Black, you're Black. That means I might understand some of the things that you're going through. Mm-hmm. I might have a similar experience. It's no guarantee, but there's a hope there. The unfortunate thing about that is that means that often in these small minority groups, you might see that person outside and there is a closer proximity. And sometimes people don't want proximity, and that's fine and that's fair, and that they should have that choice. Unfortunately, for a lot of people, they've got to choose proximity versus inclusion.
Why do they not want proximity?
So, for example, I am an Ethiopian woman living in Melbourne. If I see another Ethiopian woman, for example, as a client, I will always warn them. I warn all African clients, actually, given our small numbers here in Australia, that we might see each other. And seeing your therapist in a space that you don't want to see is, you know, you don't necessarily will be prepared for that. Mm. And you might not want to have that conversation of like, oh, I just met you at Coles. Do I say hi to you? Do I not say hi to you? What do I do with that? Do I identify? Do I not identify? And that is the privilege of often white folk working in any space that's like a helping space, right? They don't have to necessarily see their community all the time. Yeah. Whether I'm working as a therapist, whether I'm working as a nurse, I can't switch off this identity. So being that recognizable face, you might see me at a community event, you might see me elsewhere, and you might not want to have that. You might not want your therapist to be out in the club, like fucking twerking while you're twerking, and you're like, bitch.
I'll see you next week. Like, yeah.
We still got that prep when on Friday, right? Yeah, gotcha. All right, anyway, like, you don't want that situation to happen, and you should have a right to choose that. For us in particular, some of our pain is within our own communities. Mm. Some of our pain is within our own families, within our circles. Sometimes that pain is too much to heal on top of having someone else within your community see you.
Oh, that's such a word. How is that for you though, as a therapist, if you're dropping it low at an Ethiopian wedding and you see like, because again, it goes back to the point, like the community is being small. So how many therapists are there within Black Ethiopian communities in Melbourne? You could be like one of two, right? So you're dropping it low at the function and you see like three of your clients. What's that like for you?
So like, ah! No, well, I essentially, oh, I'll see you later. I, in particular, make sure I go out of my way to have it with African clients just because of the over proximity in Melbourne. But I think as a figure who is also on social media and has a public profile on social media, that's the conversation that I'm going to be having regardless. Mm-hmm. And that conversation is around boundaries. The conversation is around not having, you know, kind of conflicting roles with someone. You know, you can't be someone's friend and their therapist. You can't be someone's relative and their therapist. There needs to be boundaries around that. And unfortunately, sometimes those boundaries mean that we need to negotiate what that looks like outside of this room. And I know for social media, for a lot of mental health workers, for a lot of social workers on social media that have profiles, this is not therapy. This is not an equivalent of therapy. And that goes for this podcast as well. But this, what I'm saying now, isn't an equivalent of speaking with a mental health worker in an individual setting. This is all subjective, right? But essentially, what we need to do is we need to create boundaries of our roles and our identities on there. And I say to people, yes, you can follow me. Yes, you can see my Instagram page, my Twitter page, because it is public, but I can't have another relationship with you outside of this room. So on that, if you do message me, if you do share my work, if you do whatever, I will not be engaging and responding to that. And I might even bring it up here. And if I see you out in the community, how do you wish to engage? What do you want me to do? How do you wish to identify? And for some people, it's like, I'm going to tell the world you're my therapist. Fine, I'm happy with that.
Yeah.
And for some people, it's like, hey, do you mind if I choose? Because if I'm like at a family gathering and ain't nobody here knows I have a therapist, or maybe, you know, I don't want them to know. And I don't want them to be like, hey, what the hell is wrong with you? Why do you have a therapist? Because of the stigma that exists around therapy.
Mm. Well, let's go to that. Let's go to that stigma. Let's go to not wanting people to know. Because you know what gets me, Tigis, with a lot of this, right? I'm Ghanaian. It's probably very similar to you in many ways in terms of being Ethiopian and having that community core. It's such a big thing. And I guess for my parents as well, why they find it so hard to engage with therapy is because they've grown up with that all the time. I get that. But what also messes me up with that, yeah, is your community is who you go to heal or confide in, but you're actually not honest with your community. There's so much shame. Nobody actually knows what's happening in this house. We're like, oh, don't say this at the barbecue. Don't tell auntie this. A lot of secrets. Like, I feel like every year a big secret is dropped on me. I don't know if any other Africans can relate, but like, and they definitely wouldn't share it with their community for a lot of those reasons. how do we reconcile like not feeling the ability? A lot of it's also because of safety, like not being able to be honest. Maybe you're queer, or maybe like, you know, there's something happening. There's like your relationship is falling apart as a marriage, and maybe you're a woman and you feel like you can't leave. So how do we reconcile relying on community with not being able to be honest with community? How do those things connect?
There's this funny, it's a quote, and I'm notoriously bad for like getting the right quote with the right person at the right time. Okay. So I'm very well known for this. The quote is around the idea that I'm in therapy for all the people in my life that should be in therapy. So the realities are that we're going to have people in our lives who have had experiences and who have had ways of dealing with, whether it's their emotions, of how they engage with people, or how they engage with themselves, that becomes a pattern of behavior. Mm. And as individuals, we're often the cycle breakers, especially as young African kids now, who are a lot more aware than maybe their parents were, starting to create change, that we are going to be those cycle breakers. And how do we reconcile with that is, I think, got to do with around those boundaries of the community spaces that are for healing are there for your parents. And maybe their version of what it is going to be really different for your version, right? But whether or not they're healing from it, whether or not they are or they're not, I think the concept of mental health and how that sits with a lot of the older generation is something that we're trying to unlearn as a younger generation. A lot of Black people who are African who come to our service are saying, hey, I don't think anyone in my family or community is going to know I'm here. And part of that is a choice that they've made because they've deemed it unsafe. Mm-hmm. And I'm not that young, but I know that there's so much stigma around in all communities, by the way. This is not just a Black thing.
Yeah.
It's not an Asian thing. This is in all communities. The idea of needing help is, you know, seen in a negative light. I really empathize with a lot of people who are dealing with family members whom they love and they really wish to connect with, who don't have, whether it's the emotional maturity, the lack of understanding. And I know for me, coming from a refugee background, a lot of it's like their ways of dealing with really difficult and traumatic events, of moving to another country, of having to, you know, assimilate and being afraid of your culture dying, your language dying, of losing your identity. But at the same time, the verses of then coming to Australia and being rejected by this culture here.
Yeah.
And I think I have so much empathy for that group and for a whole few generations of people who've had to experience this. But I also understand that it can feel like their burdens and it can feel like their trials and tribulations are yours as well. And that's what we call intergenerational, whether it's pain, whether it's trauma, or intergenerational cycles of like, I'm carrying this from you, whether it's this idea of I've got God, I don't need therapy, or of we don't need to talk about whatever. Is it because that's what they've been taught? Is it because that's how they understand things, or they've been able to? They're okay with just shutting things down and continuing on all the time. And that is a norm for a lot of people. So being the person who doesn't think this is okay, you can feel a bit gaslit from your family, but your family either don't understand or are choosing not to understand. I empathize because everyone's journey is going to be really different. And for me, as a therapist, I had to do a lot of psychoeducation and like home training for my family about what therapy is. And it was over time that kind of was understood, right? Because a lot of my family can understand help for others, but not help for self. They can say, oh, yeah, that's great that other people are getting help. And as soon as I say, I'm seeing a therapist, because I remember a story of when I had this really significant car accident that involved four other vehicles, so four vehicles including myself, and I found it really difficult to drive afterwards, and I would, you know, be having real panic attacks, like thinking of driving. I would have nightmares about it, and my family was a bit worried too, because they were like, oh, you haven't driven for a few days. And I didn't tell them I saw a therapist until afterwards. I saw a therapist for a few sessions just around processing that and sitting with some of that. And I had to do all this work to explain to my family why I would see a therapist after driving and having that incident as a therapist. Like, they've been knowing of the work that I do, but it was around like their fears and holding their fears and being able to say, in terms of, are you okay? No, I wasn't okay in those moments.
Yeah.
But that's why I saw a therapist. And that's why I continue to see therapy, to ensure that I'm okay. I should have told us that, well, that's not your job. And it was through this kind of like slow education of my own family, which is an emotional burden for me. Mm. So hence why I ask clients to say, you know that this is not going to be a one-sided conversation. Is, you know, if and when you do decide to do this, be aware of, you know, the potential ramifications. And you disclose a lot without disclosing a lot when you see a therapist. For example, if you were to say, I am going to see an accountant, people would think it's got to do with money. It's got to do with your finances. And that's it. It could be around tax. It could be around your business. It could be around getting ready to buy a house, to buy a car. There could be so many variables of that. Right? Yeah. And in general, seeing an accountant is not seen in a negative light. If you say, I'm going to go see a therapist or a sexual assault counselor or a family violence counselor or a grief counselor, you are revealing that you are going to see an individual in regards to your mental health and getting support from that. And then if it's a sexual assault counselor, because I got sexually assaulted, or because I'm experiencing grief, there's such disclosure that happens there that doesn't happen with other services. I think if people wish to be protective of that, I encourage them to. And if people choose that after a while or immediately that they feel okay with that kind of level of exposure, then that's okay too, because you don't owe anyone shit, including your parents.
What do you think are some of those fears that perhaps clients or in your experience have come to the forefront? People think about their daughter or somebody going to therapy. What are different reasons why they may worry about that?
Because therapy is so broad, people who have an understanding of therapy can be concerned and think, oh, it's about your mental well-being, and your mental well-being can affect your work, can affect your relationships. So I'm worried for you, right? Mm-hmm. Secondly, I think mental health has also been used to weaponize our communities, right? Especially Indigenous communities here. And how someone's well-being has been used against them, things that they've disclosed has been used against them, especially around whether it's drug and alcohol, whether it's around, it has been used against you. So there's those fears. There's also fears in a lot of migrant communities about not understanding, so you fear it, right? Mm. Fourthly, by the time people get mental health intervention, it's often quite late in their therapeutic need. So essentially, someone probably should have started attending therapy or getting a diagnosis and getting medication, especially for a lot of chronic and severe mental health illnesses, a lot earlier in life, and they don't until something happens. So the association of like, it needs to be this severe in order to get help is also, we should be seeing therapists while we're having a great old time, right? It's actually quite normal to do that, and it's really encouraged. And a lot of people don't go to therapists unless there's something wrong, and then they leave when that thing that's wrong is right. While everyone has a choice of how they engage in therapy and how long they engage in it, I would encourage people to continue despite the, you know, resolution of certain issues, because it's a good practice to have to explore your thoughts and to explore your feelings in a setting that, how often do you get to do that? how often does someone listen to you unconditionally with empathy and hear you and see you and sometimes validate and sometimes challenge you? I'm not sure about you, but I live in my head. I try to therapy myself sometimes. I'm like, just not, and it doesn't work.
You're right.
But I think also the process of finding a therapist is such an interesting one, in that people sometimes see it as it didn't work. Let's see, you know, I had a bad session. I had a few bad sessions. And a lot of people talk about therapists and finding a therapist, but almost like going on a Tinder date, right? Yeah. So this idea that you have a social media profile, or whether you have a website profile, and you kind of look at it, you read it, you're going to swipe right and go, hey, I kind of like, you know, that picture and what the person's saying, whatever their values are, their modalities, I rock with it. So I swipe right, I book an appointment and meet them. And maybe on your first date, which is your first session, that chemistry ain't there.
Yeah.
Or you're unsure, or it just ain't it. It can be that. It can just be not it. And it could be because that therapist maybe was racist, or it could just be that therapist just didn't gel with you. And I would encourage everyone to then try someone else and see someone else. And often it's not just talk-based therapy that's out there. You can do, yeah, talk-based therapy is like that classic one-on-one conversation. There's couples therapy. But there's also things like art therapy, trauma-based yoga. There's peer support. There's group therapy. There's so many alternative avenues that you can engage in with a facilitator, engage in without a facilitator, to get support or to have a way of kind of processing what your experiences are.
I think that's such a good and a really important reminder for folks. But I think as well, like, that can be intimidating, like, or such an emotional mountain, perhaps have to re-explain things. But I think it's a worthwhile pursuit, right? To find that person that will hopefully mean you can stay there.
Just in terms of the first session, you actually don't have to give your whole history every first session. You can rock up with questions for your therapist. And on the Polypsychology page, we actually have a blog around preparing for your first session and things that you can ask. But you can Google these things. A lot of people have written questions about it, and you might have some particular questions that you have for yourself that you'd want the therapist to answer, or you just might be like, what can I gain from you? These are some of the issues that I have, things that I could unpack in this space. How would you unpack? What modalities would you have a right to ask these questions? Yeah, you don't have to open up this vault of like vulnerable insecurity or trauma or in the first session or in the first couple of sessions. Your therapist is a person and they are providing a service for you. So they can be accountable to you and they should be responsive to you. And they, if they have troubles answering around their modality, if they have troubles answering around what they can provide, you can connect with someone else. Unfortunately, it does come at a cost to you. So whether it's the session fee, whether it's the number of Medicare that you have, if you're in the Medicare rebate system or any other insurance system, but you can ask from them about these things.
Yeah. That, I love how you're emphasizing that it's a service. Yeah, I think that's
You pay for it. And it's not a friendship, or it's not, you know, and even if it was free, it's still a service.
Yeah, you're right. I think this actually ties into what you were saying about shopping for a therapist. Mm-hmm. I'm going to use shopping. Is that the right term? I don't know. Finding a therapist, seeking a therapist.
Shopping's fine, yeah.
Yeah, I'm going to throw it back to like when I went to my first therapist, who was that white man. And I remember people who are overseas in Australia, there is like a program through the government where you can get that subsidized or free sessions depending on your age. And so I went to the in-house GP to be able to get that free service. And you'd know more about this, but they do like a brief evaluation, I guess you could say, to see if, and then they give you those sessions. And you know what's so funny in that session? He didn't believe me. So I went in there and actually told my therapist about this encounter, because it was at their therapy center. That's like an in-house GP. I got in there and I was talking to him a little bit about how I was feeling at the time. And I'd gone there because of like an acute trauma. Like I'd got, because something really major happened and I really wanted to talk about it. And so he kept asking me questions about like, are you sure that it's that you're feeling depressed? Like you seem to be okay. Like I remember feeling so, I think I actually cried when I left. I was like, now a professional is coming to me. And I know it wasn't in my head. Like I for sure know this is the reality of it. He didn't believe that I was in pain. He flat out said that I don't believe this is actually serious. That's what he literally said to me.
It's like, what's it to you?
Thank you.
Do you think it's serious or not? I'm trying to like give you space so you can talk, but also like understanding the fact that, and why are you a gatekeeper to me receiving help?
Mm.
And this is what I talk about, like how white supremacy invades itself into these spaces. Because they're the gatekeepers of who gets help and who not. Believe it or not, you're not my therapist, all right? So if you can just sign these papers and, you know, sorry to everyone listening to this, but essentially what is done is like it's a K-10. So it's this idea of like you check someone's anxiety and mood and like risk assessment is done. So just to ensure that they're okay, and that ends up getting sent to your therapist anyway. So they see that. And I just... I genuinely wonder at what people think when they do this, because this is every fucking story that they didn't believe I was sick, or they didn't believe that I wasn't angry. They actually thought I was pissed off. And it's like, what parts of me made you think I was pissed off other than your own assumptions?
And I think that a lot of that is to do with being a Black woman, period. And that's what I told my therapist, because he was quite surprised by that. And the reason why I share that is because I think particularly for Black women, dealing with the perception of always looking strong is really, really difficult. People always mention Black women and strength all the time, especially people who aren't Black, right? The strong Black women, you see it on TV shows, you see it everywhere. Like, do you find that in your work, is that an issue that you encounter?
I think lacking recognition for our humanity is the thing that we have to unpack a lot of the time. And both in the therapy space with often the Black client, but also outside in the world who fails to see our humanity. And it, whether it's the strong Black woman trope or the strong Black man trope, the Jezebel, so the sexualized Black woman, or whatever racialized perception that exists, all it does is it dehumanizes us. And it exists within whiteness, dehumanizes other racial groups and other identities. So what happens in the therapeutic space is that we have consumed this for so long that we often think that it's part of our identity and part of the way we behave. And unlearning this can be really, really difficult. But your example, it was that GP needing to learn why he views Black people in a particular way, because there is medical evidence about this. There is scientific evidence around how, I'm not sure of the numbers here specifically, but I know in the States that African American women are more likely to experience death giving birth or major serious medical complications giving birth because their pain isn't believed.
Yeah.
All right. So, and I'm sure this happens here to Indigenous folk. I'm sure this happens to African communities here as well and other Black identifying communities. And the idea of humanity and not being seen, I think the way it can manifest within ourselves and the way it can manifest, or I see it manifest in the therapeutic space, is that we now become our own internal oppressors. So we have lowered expectations of ourselves, or have unrealistically high expectations of ourselves,
mm-hmm.
or we don't believe that we should receive particular treatment.
I think it goes back to you talking about people not seeing the humanity in Black women and affording them vulnerability, tenderness, and care. How do you think that can impact Black women specifically?
Well, I remember writing a bit about how the concept of strength comes from necessity sometimes, mm. not biology. Yeah. And for us, it's this idea that, you know, often we have to be quote unquote strong. So Black and woman, right? So yeah. as a woman, we experience certain oppression, and either this will be magnified if you're a queer woman, if you're a trans woman, if you are a Muslim woman, and the further down your intersex that you go, that separate yourself from the mainstream. So if you're a queer, trans, you know, disabled woman, then you would experience all those levels of oppression, right?
Yeah,
but for Black women, and, you know, women being as broad as it can be, you're experiencing this as a woman, right? So you're experiencing that there, and then you experience of your Blackness as a Black person, the concept that we can experience more than others and we'll be okay is so normalized that it's seen as part of our biology.
Mm-hmm.
So I can put on and put on you. And from the oppressor side, it means it dehumanizes you so that your level of trauma has to be so high for me to acknowledge it. And from the internal, so within the community, it means that we now see that as a characteristics of ourselves, mm-hmm. instead of something that we've had to experience. We've had to experience strength because, you know, of this, you know, refugee experience, for example. So, you know, I would say my mom's a strong woman to have gone through that, mm-hmm. Because she had to experience choosing whether or not, you know, to flee or to stay. So there was a certain level of strength that was forced upon her,
yeah.
that she had to then embody, and she's quite proud of that, you know, despite all this, I made it through. But what can then happen is that can become an expectation, an individual characteristic,
mm-hmm.
and that means that we are externally and within the community dehumanizing ourselves, because I think I'm fragile as fuck. That's my honest opinion.
Retweet that. I rebranded into a baby girl because, like, I'm literally a baby girl. I need help.
My hair is fragile. I'm fragile. My community is fragile. We need to be treated with tender, loving care in the same way that you treat Karen and Dylan and, mm-hmm. you know, Dazza and all that people with tender, loving care. You need to treat me with tender, loving care. Thank because. You. Not only do I deserve it, but my generations before me deserved it.
Mm-hmm.
And if maybe you saw me as a human, maybe we wouldn't have been treated this way. It's not just the strong Black woman trope, right? It's tropes around sexuality, about how we are perceived, about being humorous, about being athletic. There's yeah. so many in there, right? And a lot of that is around our access to power as well. Like, if we are seen as athletic and being able to have, like, be able to do certain particular sports, that's the way we access, you know, money or in social status and all that kind of stuff. But then we are then also seen as this thing that can just be quantified and can be consumed. It's really damaging because it's hitting us from both sides. It's hitting us from the oppressor side, and it's hitting us from our own internal community. Or we sometimes minimize our own pain and go, I'm not strong enough. You know, instead of being like, my mom shouldn't have experienced that.
Mm-hmm.
Her mom shouldn't have experienced that. And I damn well shouldn't have experienced that. We're not just this huge, vast swimming pool of access and pain, right? So, and a lot of that mm-hmm. work is not just in our communities. I want to be really clear. But it's the things that's being put onto us, like your doctor that you talked about, or the Karen in your workplace
yeah.
who goes, she was being mean to me. All I said was, that's not my name. I wasn't being mean to you. Like, why did you perceive that as mean?
Truly.
You're being mean to me. I'm hurt. Like, it's really hard. It's really difficult. I think the work that we do is revolutionary, regardless if you're going to self, if you're doing self-care, if you're engaging in therapy, it's revolutionary. It is a thing that will most often change so many people around you, because you're healing, and we don't exist in vacuums. We don't have individualistic societies. We'll have that domino effect on other people. And if it doesn't, that's fine, but most likely it will.
I want to ask you personally, like, I love how you described yourself as fragile. I just think, like, some people hearing that will just feel so connected. Was it hard for you to proclaim that and accept that and say that?
You know, I think I'm still trying to claim it, but the reality is for me is that I'm noticing that people see sensitivity as a bad thing. Oh, everyone's so sensitive. Sensitivity is an awful thing. But when I actually deconstruct what sensitivity is, for me, it's like, oh, I'm considerate of other people's feelings. I'm considerate of my own. I'm aware of how things impact me. And I try to adapt and change with that. And that definition for me is fine. Like, I'm like, oh, girl, that's good. That's not a bad thing. That's what I want, yeah. Right? Yeah. If a lot of people did that shit for me, maybe I wouldn't be a therapist, right?
Mm. Yeah.
That's my reality, right? So I think it's difficult. It's hard. You know, hopefully your therapist has a therapist who has a therapist, because we too are human, and we need to also figure out how things impact us in order to do this work.
Yeah.
And if enough people actually were considerate and thought about not just how they impact others, but how shit's impacting them, I think if we did a lot more of that uncomfortable sitting with, you know, the harsh ugliness and truth about some of us, because I have to unlearn transphobia. I have to unlearn ableism, to unlearn these things, to that I've been indoctrinated into thinking a particular way about things, right? I have to unlearn colorism. I still privilege from colorism as a light-skinned African woman, but I have to learn, then unlearn.
Can we just, like, stop relying on Black women to save people? I just want Black women to rest. Like, anytime I see Black women doing things, I'm like, whether they're older or younger, my age, I just want you to rest and feel that tenderness.
Just clap for everyone I see. I'm like, I'm rooting for anyone Black.
Literally. Awesome. Hooray.
And last but not least, who are you rooting for tonight?
I'm rooting for everybody Black. I am. Betting on Black tonight.
Is that Black people yet? No, there's not. Okay, so is there any other minority group? Yeah, I'm rooting for you. But whatever you are, I am here for you. And unfortunately, a lot of what occurs, especially around racism, is around anti-Blackness, whether it's in the Asian community, whether it's in the white community, whether it's in brown communities, or whomever community you're existing in, is that it's the spectrum of anti-Blackness. So really, in solidarity with that, if I'm here for anyone who most often is in a minority group, I was the one who had a majority of her friends have some kind of minority identification, because shit, that's just how things worked. That's who I made friends with, and that's who I wished to see around me, because they could empathize with me, and I know that their oppression occurs often racially because of my oppression or the way that they view Blackness.
Yeah.
So, you know, and it's it being the furthest thing from whiteness.
That's such a good point. And I've actually been thinking about that a lot lately, as there's been a lot more conversations about anti-Blackness in non-Black communities of all different backgrounds. Like, a lot of Black feminist scholars and thinkers have always said we should frame racism in terms of proximity to Blackness, not to whiteness, because the core of it is actually anti-Blackness. And Black feminist theory has been saying that from day dot. So I love that you brought it back to anti-Blackness specifically.
100%. there's a whole thing around Black burnout that a lot of people experience when they're inundated with trauma. And I think that happens for so many people. And, you know, my research that I've done, you know, online, I'm not a theorist, and my understandings of Black burnout is around it being like physical, mental, emotional, spiritual stress that we experience from being Black and existing in an anti-Black world. That this is not our own individual failings, but the failings of the anti-Blackness and how it's rooted in our politics, in our structures, in our justice, in our healing as well, and how anti-Blackness was present in mental health, in medical spaces. So I think understanding that anti-Blackness not only can be part of the pain that you experience, but it can manifest itself physically, emotionally, as stress, as anxiety. So for those who don't understand what burnout is like a state of emotional, physical, and spiritual, mental, all of that exhaustion caused by excessive and prolonged stress. Black burnout is all of that, but caused by anti-Blackness. Yes. So it can occur individually and collectively. It can be historical pain, so it can be generational pain or colonial pain. It can be experienced one-on-one, or it can be experienced vicariously through the consumption of Black trauma. Yes. So during, whether it's BLM or if you see someone else, if you see someone get hurt or experience racism, I know that watching other people experience racism can really trigger my own pain as well. Mm-hmm. And, you know, there is systemic and institutional inequality that can cause Black burnout. It's the idea of what you said about having to be strong. So working, experiencing massage noir or colorism, all these kind of like intersectional ways of experiencing pain and overwhelming stress, right? And that can manifest itself in like three domains. So burnout manifests itself essentially through inefficiency, exhaustion, and cynicism. In America, there was a study by a Black woman, and I think she called it withering, and that's like the physical effects of like trauma on a Black people, how our body just withers away. I go a lot into this on Instagram and stuff, but for healing, I would say that because our pain isn't individual, our healing doesn't have to be individual either. Because it's around anti-Blackness, we experience anti-Blackness as communities as well. So I put it in three domains of healing or responding to Black burnout. And that is, there's an individual, and then there's a Black community, and the third one is allies. So as an individual, the things that we can do, you know, whether it's self-care related, whether it's therapeutically related, or creating boundaries, increasing your rest, like Black rest.
Everything.
Phenomenal. It is life-changing. It is deserved. It is needed. It is part of our healing that we rest, because part of not being seen as human and part of our humanity being taken away from us is the fact that we don't get rest. And then the second domain is the Black community. So communal and cultural healing. Again, your parents' version of healing might be going to church and putting all their tears in prayer, or going to a mosque and putting all their tears into a prayer and speaking to God or whomever they worship. But for you, it might be a lot different. It might be going out to eat with friends or something like that. The biggest part of that is connecting with people who have similar experiences to you. Like the banter, the jokes, Black Twitter, like it is.
Oh my gosh, yes.
And that's how we connect with community. Like I sit there and like go into comment sections on Instagram for the fun of it, because I love it. I love the amount of creativity that exists, and the ability to be able to take something that's really complicated and make it a meme, a joke, you know, a video, a storyline. So, you know, and for other people, it's like engaging in cultural practices. whether it's dancing, whether it's drumming, whether it's like going out with community and doing something different, physically there, being with the community, or online, or in whatever space that you feel comfortable, is so important. And the lucky last one is allies. And by far, this is the shortest one I have. It is literally utilizing all the money, all the power, energy, access, reach, connection, or privileges that your allies have so they can do that work. If they want to pay you, let them pay you. If they want to, you know, put you on their platform, let them put you up on their platform. Whatever privileges that they have, whatever reach that they have, whatever connections that they have, they should be helping utilize that. And within the Black community, there are various levels of oppression and various experiences of burnout. And I, being a Black woman, can still be an ally to other people within my own community because I don't experience what they do. Yeah. And just because I am Black doesn't mean that I am the most oppressed group. And it's not oppression Olympics over here. It is how do we help support each other and be allies to the same fight that we're all fighting.
Thank you so much, Tigis, for your time today and for everything that you've said. I have deeply valued. I'll gush about you afterwards that I won't put you on the spot, but no, thank you so much. This has been an amazing conversation.
Thank you. It's been lovely. It's been great. Hopefully, can't wait to see what the outcome of this, and thank you for considering me and including me and
of course.
Yeah, doing this whole thing.
The pleasure is literally all mine. Thank you so much, Tigis, again for this conversation. And I hope that you all enjoyed this episode. Make sure that you check out Tigis on Instagram at the Tenor Therapist for some incredible resources, which I think you would really benefit from. I also want to leave a community generated directory of mental health support and programs for First Nations folks, African folks, other Black folks, other ethnicities. This is created by at our directory on Instagram. I also recognize that everybody has different needs, but I'm going to leave that there in case anybody across so-called Australia and New Zealand is looking for somebody. Also, any folks from overseas who have any sort of similar directories, so shoot me an email or a message and I'll definitely put it in the episode notes as well. That's it. Thank you so much for listening again. This has been The Subtlety of It. My name is Nana. You can find me on Instagram at The Subtlety of It. I would love to chat to you there. As you know, it is no dates, bish. I will be back when I'm back. And actually, I will be back with the season finale. This is the second last episode of the season, so it's coming to an end. And as you know, the last episode is always super spicy, and this one is no exception. So I look forward to speaking to you then. In the meantime, please do take care, look after yourself, do what you can to prioritize your peace, your health, your healing, and more. And yeah, I will speak to you soon. Okay, bye.